Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And I think we're going to take a little break, a welcome respite, call it, on this Friday from the machinations in Washington that have so dominated headlines, the news reality, and this program for the past several weeks. Oh, yes, we'll keep you up to date a little later this hour on one or two of the important developments in D.C. now that the fog of the Obamacare debt ceiling wars has lifted for a while anyway. We'll also explore the reality of the new film 12 Years a Slave and consider the value of daydreaming on a full day or any other day. No time for that now. Daydreaming coming up. We begin, though, with God's seemingly secure place in American culture. Or is it?
He will not be mocked. The greatest deception here is this is not one nation under God. It never was.
Did you catch that moment of a congressional stenographer at the end of the weary battles between Democrats and Republicans losing it there with some evangelical tirade? Call it a bizarre sample of some deeper debate over the role of religion in America.
I walk through the valley of the shadow where death is. Top floor, if you alone, and leave you breathless.
Something sampled from the tapestry of our pop culture, like hip-hop artists. So many young Americans, you might say, are DJs of their spiritual identity.
Most of us kind of consider it sort of a buffet style. Pick and choose the different aspects of previous religious traditions.
Broke out of the mold.
Pork eating, alcohol drinking, premarital sex having variety.
Young people sampling the religion of their upbringing.
Why should you treat people well? Well, I mean, because you have a duty to, because of social contract.
I'm just as likely to read, you know, the story of the Tower of Babel in the Bible as I am to read a story by Isaac Babel.
Growing up in Islam, I have a direct connection with God, and I get to say what that relationship is like.
And creating something that may feel like spirituality to them, but doesn't exactly sound like a churchy hymn.
You cannot serve two masters. Praise be to God.
I want to talk to God, but I'm afraid because we spoke so long.
The sampling of religious tradition did not begin with the millennial generation of the hip-hop era we've been exploring all this week. America is a land of religious renewal, a place to come and practice free of the constraints of tradition. From the Puritans to the Amish to the Mormons and Reformed Jewish movement in America, this country is a laboratory of spirituality far more complex than the ubiquitous slogan, "In God We Trust." But in our last look at this issue on this Friday, heading into the traditional weekend days of rest, none other than Krista Tippett, the host of the public radio program On Being and the author of Speaking of Faith, says this generation may be onto something new with global implications for all religions.
It's definitely true that religious identity is as fluid and a matter of personal choice, I think, than it's been in human history for many centuries, if ever. You know, just as we don't inherit other kinds of identity that we adhere to, religious identity has been kind of unmoored from necessarily being identified with the family we grew up in, the church we went to, the synagogue we went to. What's been interesting to me to watch, and I'm not sure this gets so reflected in polls, which, you know, are flat in a sense, is that this spirituality of the millennials is not the new age superficial spirituality of the 80s and 90s. This is also the generation that has a huge service orientation. This is the generation that's given us social entrepreneurialism. And so even as they detach from institutional affiliation, and that's really what the Pew polls are measuring, I find a lot of these people who describe themselves as non-religious or non-affiliated as, you know, incredibly ethically engaged, spiritually curious, and even theologically curious. So that's what I've been watching evolve. And that, to me, just seems to be deepening.
I'm sensing a Calvinism meets crowdsourcing here, a stewardship and service affiliated with the new digital social identities.
I really feel in some ways that a lot of these millennials, a lot of these what the Pew people have also called the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, you know, no affiliation,
right.
Maybe we may look back 50 years from now and say, this was a force for spiritual renewal. You know, change always comes from the margins. And as I say, what a lot of these people are about, their critique of organized religion, is that it got that it's not about service. It's not about spiritual depth. It does not have a nourishing, redemptive influence on public life. And I tweeted about this a couple months ago, and I heard from all kinds of pastors and rabbis who have churches and congregations filled with these people who profess no affiliation, but they are there to get at what they see as the basics.
Well, you mentioned the values transformations that took place in the 50s and 60s, and having grown up in that time, I do recall that as a kind of repudiation of organized religion as being hypocritical in some way. This yeah. seems to be a much more powerful statement of, no, it's just not really relevant to me, and so there's a reinvention going on.
Yes. They're not bothering to spend a lot of energy repudiating the institution. They just don't – you're right. They don't see it as relevant. But what I'm saying is that what they are defining as relevant and what they're crafting instead of just returning to the church or synagogue or mosque that their parents went to is – in many cases, a robust form of spiritual, ethical, even theologically grounded living. And then, as millennials grow older, it's also a natural progression in human life that you hit moments of life where you face your vulnerability, you face illness, you have children, you hit midlife, you start asking questions of meaning and purpose that you weren't asking when you were 18 or 25. And what happens in those times is that people often gravitate back towards the institutions for some of the essential things that you can't find elsewhere, like community, like ritual. So again, I'm going to be interested to see when this generation, as many of them will, return in some way to the institutions or to at least experimenting with them. They're going to bring a whole new set of questions. They're going to bring a set of practices. They're going to bring education in terms of all the things they've been reading and doing. They're going to bring a history of service. And again, I think they may be transformative for the institutions eventually.
Now, that sounds fabulous, but what if they just let us down and they just become a generation like any other? It's like basically...
Well, they will, of course.
Yes.
They will because, my favorite line of theology, I think, is Reinhold Niebuhr, the public theologian. The first line of his great book, The Nature and Destiny of Man, is man is his own most vexing problem. And it's a great truth about humanity that even when we are pursuing our highest ideals, even in our moments of greatest accomplishment, we will fail, we will be flawed, and we'll be forced to confront our dark side again. And, this generation will have its version of that. But I think in terms of a curiosity and a willingness to entertain very big ideas, I think they bring a whole different set of instincts. And those instincts are going to serve the world better than the instincts of a lot of us who came out of the latter part of the 20th century.
So, Krista Tippett, take a millennial to lunch. You might learn something about spirituality.
It's been great to talk to you. I'm so glad you did this series.
Oh, we've had a great time. It's great to talk to you as well. Krista Tippett, host of On Being and author of Speaking of Faith. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Of course, this isn't only about religion. Let's step back now and remind ourselves of the impact millennials are having and are destined to have in all aspects of American culture and politics. And for that, we turn to a voice of the post-1980 generation. She's a marketing strategist with bicoastal roots and a polyglot ethnicity, as you might expect. Marketing strategist Naz Riahi says that the key methodology for millennials is in grouping their various ideas around brands, commercial and otherwise, and communicating those ideas instantaneously through technology.
Definitely technology has played a really big role in how millennials see the world and how they see themselves within the world. For example, a lot of people talk about millennials being entitled in the sense that they think that everything should happen for them immediately. Of course, that's a result of the fact that in the technological age, things do happen very quickly. Things happen rapidly. And some people think that impatience is a negative quality. I don't think that impatience is a negative quality. I actually think it's a very positive quality in some sense. Why shouldn't things happen faster if they're able to happen faster?
You know, the other thing that's very interesting, and you write about this a lot, and you experience this, I think, in your work in branding, mm-hmm. is that millennials, and it's unique to their generation, have an extraordinary commercial fluency. They understand brands, where they come from and why, and they also understand technology. They're digital natives. That's a new sort of collision.
Well, and I think the reason we're talking so much about millennials and the reason brands are so focused on millennials is because they are the biggest age grouping in the United States. There are 80 million millennials in the U.S., and that is a lot of consumer power. Millennials are also because, as you said, they're digital natives. They've grown up with this sort of thing. You can't fool them. As a brand, you can no longer fool millennials into thinking that what you're putting out there is authentic unless it really is authentic.
Now, why do you think digital natives and commercially fluent millennials have no problem moving spiritually from place to place? Or why doesn't this make them superficial? Because some of the data suggests that they're very politically engaged, civically engaged.
They are. They're very, very politically and civically engaged. And some people refer to maybe their altruistic activity as light volunteerism because a lot of it is maybe just sharing something online or maybe texting $10 in for Sandy relief but not going back and continuing to do that. But even that little bit of activity makes a lot of difference. But coming back to your point about sort of how fluid they are within their environment, I think it's, again, a symptom of our time. We realize that we can accomplish more if we're more flexible.
And so anything that goes against that flexibility is really counterintuitive to millennials, hence some of the religious conflicts with parents that we've been seeing in our stories this week. Let's talk for a moment about why people who are interested in brands are really interested in millennials. Is that because they have really rapid word of mouth, because they text everything they do? Is that really true?
Well, absolutely. I think that it's twofold. So one is that social power. And millennials have realized that they can call out a brand on Twitter and hold that brand responsible. So millennials have pressure on brands to be more transparent, to do more social good. And I think that that's an amazing power that they have. And it's really changing the face of the way that brands conduct themselves. But also, as I said, there's 80 million millennials. They're the biggest age grouping. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of consumer power.
Let's end on a cultural note here. And taking the continuum from some of the concerns that people have about the language of bullying online, all the way to some of the entrepreneurial spirit, the sense of startup and no rules that you've described. What do you think the cultural impact of this millennial generation is likely to be on America, and we've already seen it in East Asia, mm-hmm. And the world in general?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about this, and I think technology has enabled millennials to either prove that they're a nicer generation or show that people as a whole are not as bad as we think they are. Sure, there are a lot of instances of bullying, and bullying has been around long before the internet, and it's awful, and I wish that it would stop. But a good example is Yelp, right? You go on Yelp to find reviews and to write your reviews, and I was thinking, you know, I personally never go on Yelp to write a bad review. I maybe have written two negative reviews, but 90% of the reviews I write on Yelp are five-star reviews because I want to share the things that are good out there. And I looked at some statistics that Yelp has on their website, and over 60% of their reviews are five-star reviews. That was astounding to me. Only 13% are one-star reviews, and I think something around 7% are two-star reviews. The rest are all positive.
Nasri Ahi is a marketing strategist who uses innovation and technology to allow brands to connect with consumers. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So back to Washington for a moment, and let's recall a moment nearly a year ago when a senior official in the U.S. intelligence establishment was imagining a moment that perhaps hasn't arrived yet.
There will come a tipping point at which so many of the leaders and operatives of Al-Qaeda and its affiliates have been killed or captured, and the group is no longer able to attempt or launch a strategic attack against the United States.
That's Jay Johnson speaking as the Department of Defense's senior lawyer in a speech at the Oxford Union in London. In an interview last year with the BBC, Johnson showed himself to be something of a counterterrorism hawk.
As far as the U.S. military goes, and I think I can speak for the entire U.S. government on this, given the the nature of the technology of the assets we have, which can identify particular intended individuals and identify where they are and aim our weapons, I think we do a pretty good job.
This aggressive advocate of secrecy, technology, drone warfare, and counterterrorism, and did I mention he's also a lawyer, Jay Johnson, is President Obama's pick to be head of the Department of Homeland Security, replacing Janet Napolitano, who came from state politics in Arizona as governor. Michael Schmidt, reporter for our partner, The New York Times, joins us. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
So at Homeland Security, we've now had two former governors, Janet Napolitano, who I mentioned, Tom Ridge from Pennsylvania, and two big lawyers, Michael Chertoff, and if he's confirmed, Jay Johnson. Is there a narrative here?
Well, under Napolitano, she took on a lot of the immigration issues, border security, that stuff publicly, unlike Chertoff, who was publicly dealing a lot with terrorism. And what you have now is a question about what is DHS going to focus on and what is Johnson going to focus on? Is he going to follow in Napolitano's shoes and basically focus on those issues of immigration and border security and such? Or is he going to be more vocal on counterterrorism stuff in the way that John Brennan was in the first Obama term?
What do you make of the fact that he comes from the national security establishment? I mean, he's really down there in the kind of drone approval, drone strategy kind of whiteboard group there at the Pentagon.
Well, it's interesting because we thought that it would be a governor like Napolitano and someone that would sort of follow in that model. But this is at a time when Obama has said that there needs to be a recalibration on counterterrorism, and he's bringing this guy who sort of laid the pathway to that over the past year in his public statement. So there could be a change here in sort of, you know, how DHS is used and sort of the approach to counterterrorism. What that is, they're certainly not saying, and I certainly don't expect the president, when he announces the nomination this afternoon, to go into that. But it is different than what we've seen before.
Michael Schmidt, maybe a clue lies in a longer version of a clip we played right in the introduction to this segment. I want to play it for you. It's from that Oxford Union speech that Jay Johnson gave last year. Listen.
In the current conflict with al-Qaeda, I can offer no prediction about when this conflict will end, or whether we are, as Winston Churchill once described it, near the, quote, beginning of the end, end quote. I do believe that on the present course, there will come a tipping point at which so many of the leaders and operatives of al-Qaeda and its affiliates have been killed or captured, and the group is no longer able to attempt or launch a strategic attack against the United States, such that al-Qaeda as we know it, the organization that our Congress authorized the military to pursue in 2001, has been effectively destroyed.
Jay Johnson, the designate for Homeland Security in the Obama administration. Before we go, Michael Schmidt, is he making an argument for a permanent state of war, and will Homeland Security look that way given the Snowden revelations? How are the confirmation hearings likely to go?
Well, no, I mean, it's interesting because the confirmation hearings could be a way for the discussion about the end to the war on terrorism or what happens to the war on terrorism. That could be sort of a forum for that. I don't think he's advocating a constant state of war in the sense of the counterterrorism war. I think what he's saying is that there's going to come a time when maybe we don't need to have the military and legal footing and sort of posture that we have now, which started after 9/11. And the question is, when does that come to an end, or does it ever come to an end? And I think that this is something that the administration is really thinking a lot about, and his confirmation hearing could give a chance for others to sort of weigh in on it because we haven't really had a lot of discussion on it.
Well, a great takeaway there, something to look forward to, and whether the Secretary of Homeland Security will have anything to say about when that moment, that tipping point, has arrived. Michael Schmidt, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Schmidt, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. So, a little about me here. Baptized as a Presbyterian, can still remember my scratchy wool Sunday suit for church in Rochester, New York. Then my dad went on a spiritual journey as I grew up, and we were all dragged to the Unitarian Church. Nice place, no scratchy suits. They liked to talk about how they didn't believe in miracles or God or the Bible in any literal way. The Unitarians in Syracuse, New York, liked to have Muslim Sunday services or Jewish services sometimes. We would have atheist speakers occasionally. There'd be Buddhists. But our family eventually ended up at a church in Grand Rapids, Michigan, a lapsed Baptist church with some very independent Unitarian-like free thinkers. Really nice choir, hard wooden pews, and out there in the audience, some scratchy suits. Now, with five kids, I have some trouble explaining my religious background with any clarity to them, but that's just my story. All that is by way of mentioning that you can chat your own religious story to me and with me at our live chat later today. It's the end of our discussion that we've been having all week about young people under God, the changing face of American religion. Join me at thetakeaway.org today at 2 p.m. Eastern for a live chat on the changing role of religion. I'll be joined by Lisa Pierce, a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina. You can wear your scratchy suit if you want, and together we'll answer your questions and examine religion in America.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Not exactly religious, but it is a ritual for us here on Friday, Movie Day, with Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer from the Movie Day podcast. Kristen, of course, is culture producer for The Takeaway. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John. Hi, John.
Kind of a zeitgeisty weekend here. I think Benedict Cumberbatch is part of the zeitgeist. He's got two offerings this week. And also, we've got some really interesting sort of cultural movies in play. But let's begin with Carrie, a remake of Carrie. How could you possibly remake the most scary, insane movie of all time?
A man or a woman who is a witch among you is to be put to death. You are to stone them.
I'm warning you, Mama. The devil's hand. Please don't do this.
When I saw the original Carrie, I was scared of my own parents for months. Rafer, how did this one work out?
Well, that's Chloe Grace Moretz we're hearing as Carrie, Julianne Moore as her crazy mother. No real replacement for Sissy Spacek and Piper Laurie. And I have to say, Kimberly Pierce, the director of Boys Don't Cry, who I thought would be a good choice for this, maybe bring something kind of feminist and different to Carrie, just basically tries to recreate the De Palma version. It doesn't work. And there's, you know, De Palma's prom scene in Carrie. It's unstoppable.
Unstoppable.
It's incredible. It can't hold a candle, this one.
I have
buckets
to...
of pig blood can't work.
That's still there. Still.
I have to fully agree with Rafer on this one. I was a little bit sad because I also thought Pierce would be great at this movie. But that prom scene, every time Chloe Grace Moretz is trying to, through telekinesis, make things happen, she really just looks like Tom Cruise in Minority Report moving holograms around. And it's
nice.
it's just kind of campy, more campy than it is scary.
Speaking of zeitgeist, the Fifth Estate takes up Julian Assange and the founding of WikiLeaks.
This is information the world needs to know. So the next time you find yourself lecturing me about this organization, please try to remember why I created it and why I hired you to help me.
Benedict Cumberbatch, a star. I'm obsessed with him because of Star Trek. What do you think, Kristen?
I love him, but this movie just really illustrates once again how hard it is to make a movie about computers. It's hard to watch people just sitting at computers. It's hard to watch people typing on their computers. And it just isn't as exciting as you want it to be.
Better as a frontline, Rafer?
Yeah, although Benedict Cumberbatch is incredible. He's so good in this movie, but I agree with Kristen. It's pretty dull, pretty wonky, ultimately.
And Benedict is also in our third offering this weekend.
Days ago, I was with my family.
and my home. Now you tell me all is lost. Tell no one who I am. That's the way to survive. Well, I don't want to survive. I want to live.
The extraordinary voice from the movie 12 Years a Slave, Benedict Cumberbatch, just part of that ensemble cast. Rafer, this is an amazing movie.
Yeah, this is Chiwetel Ejiofor. That's him playing Solomon Northup, a slave who was actually a free black man who was actually kidnapped and turned into a slave in the 1800s. It's an incredible film. It's a kind of slave story that I think we've never heard before, and it's done with a kind of artistry that I personally have never seen before.
Over the top?
It was unbelievable. It's great. And it's violent, it's brutal, but I think that the most affecting thing in the movie is actually the psychological dehumanizing nature of slavery. And it's so smart because it sets it up so that we can relate to it. We're also free when the movie starts. We're going down this path with him and we're coming out with him. It's just incredible.
More time to explore that on the Movie Date podcast this week?
Actually, this week we're launching a new feature called Movie Therapy, where we're helping our listeners with their life issues by prescribing them movies. And this week we have a man who wants some makeout help with the ladies.
How come I don't get benefit of this help? Rafer Guzman, Kristen Meinzer, the Movie Date podcast. Rafer, film critic for Newsday. Kristen, culture producer for The Takeaway. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks,
you too, John.
A little background now on that film, 12 Years a Slave, which with its wide release today is expected to have a big impact on America's race discourse. Activist and educator Renee Moore, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, John.
So what do people need to understand about the real history of Solomon Northup, the man in the story at the center of 12 Years a Slave?
Well, he was, of course, well-educated. He was an inventor, by the way. He invented a fish trap, which I think a lot of people don't know. He had three children, Margaret, Elizabeth, and Alonzo. And in an effort to earn his more wages for his family, he was abducted. He was promised that he would be able to find work. So he was a literate man, a man of faith, because repeatedly in his book, he speaks of God and his love for his family. And I think in many ways, society demonizes black men. And so this flies in the face of that notion that that black men really do love their families. And so then this story represents more than just one man's abduction during antebellum time in America. Free blacks were kidnapped and taken south for the money, because they were paid to bring back labor for the South. And so any myth about inferiority is really based on the fact that this was done to substantiate this cognitive dissonance, to allow the inferiority to justify, if you will, slavery in the South.
Turning people into commodities, and commodities that could be snatched off the streets of Saratoga Springs. How important has this story been in the community of Saratoga Springs? And I know you've been very, very central to making sure people in Saratoga Springs understand the Solomon Northup story.
It wasn't always easy. There were some people who exhibited obstructionist behavior, but over the years it was difficult. I did it single-handedly for at least a decade, but the film has brought a lot of attention to the book, and in that way I hope that this story will get out to everyone and they will better understand the importance that there's a truce to American history, that youth in particular, African-American youth need to know whose shoulders they stand on, who made the sacrifices for them to be where they are. And I think we owe it to the ancestors to stand strong for ourselves and our families. And in this country, we've never had a truth and reconciliation process. So there's a lot of uncovering, not to make anybody feel uncomfortable, but to understand how far African-Americans really have come in a very short time, and to acknowledge that to both blacks and whites that we've survived a horrendous Holocaust.
Which is why there is a Solomon Northup Day, an official city holiday in Saratoga Springs. When is Solomon Northup Day?
It's historically been held the third Saturday in July. And this year it was held at Skidmore College, Filene Hall. So we had a wonderful venue, about 250 people. and some descendants, I might add, about 62 descendants, some of them meeting each other for the very first time.
Wow, that's remarkable. So with the release of the film, and certainly it's getting a lot of attention, you could be going national with Solomon Northrop Day next year. What do you think?
Oh, I hope so, or at least it will be continued here by the citizens of Saratoga Springs. I think it's an opportunity for white and black to come together to discuss issues and look at each other in the face and sort of acknowledge, because we need to learn from our history. History for history's sake is nice, and that's what our historians do. But knowing the truth of American history that's often not taught in schools, African-American people particularly, we need to know that we're survivors of a great Holocaust, and we have nothing to be ashamed of about ourselves. The country was built on the backs of black people, not just Saratoga, but the entire country.
Renee Moore, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, Renee Moore, thanks so much. Educator, activist, founder of Solomon Northrop Day in Saratoga Springs, New York. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Well, Congress finally gave itself a new deadline in a few weeks to be undistracted by debt ceilings and continuing resolutions, but looming over all this is the political urgency and the even greater social urgency to pass meaningful immigration reform legislation. The challenge for lawmakers has been reconciling the conflict between the values of U.S. border security and the values of keeping American society open to the diversity and expertise from foreigners eager to come and seek their fortunes here in the United States. But what do we as a society fundamentally want to get out of America's traditionally welcoming, if cautious, relationship with the rest of the world? This deeper debate is unlikely to happen in the U.S. Congress as we head into the 2014 election cycle. The question is out there, though. History professor Paul Collier tries to raise some of these fundamental questions about the good and bad of recent economic migration patterns in his new book, Exodus: Immigration and Multiculturalism in the 21st Century.
Immigration of the bright, the educated, the energetic is good for America. It's not necessarily good for the countries they leave. That's again a matter of balance, that some emigration is a good thing for countries. China and India have benefited a lot. But a lot of poor countries hemorrhage their talent, and that traps them into perpetuated poverty. And so from their perspective, having their bright and educated flee to America is not such a good thing.
Would controls that would keep people leaving poor countries, if they're smart and ambitious, and you describe a lot of the most positive, at least personal aspects of migration among these groups, is something that would prevent that happening in an Eritrea or an Ethiopia? The responsibility of richer countries, wealthier countries, to make sure that there are development strategies that keep those people in their own lands.
Absolutely. So we should start by doing what we can for the poor countries of the world to catch up. And so generous aid policies, generous trade policies that enable poor countries to catch up is very sensible. Similarly, migration for education is really helpful, especially where people go back. So young people coming to America, getting education, getting new perspectives on life, and then going back to their countries, we can show quite rigorously that that is very beneficial both to America and to the poorest countries. So that sort of migration is really helpful.
When there's a return and the benefit from being in the United States rubs off inside the country where they're returning.
That's right. That's right. But the problems of the poor countries will never be solved just by an exodus of their best people, obviously. The nearest we come to that is Ireland, where half the population left after the Great Famine, but it still took Ireland 150 years before it started to catch up. So emigration was very good for the Irish who moved to America, but it wasn't very good for the Irish who stayed back home.
You know, foreign aid is often a target of right-wing politicians in the United States. Can you formulate an argument, because right-wing politicians are also on a particular side in the immigration reform debate, often, not exclusively. Can you formulate an argument that would say foreign aid to nations that send citizens or are the origin of citizens coming to the United States, that foreign aid is a form of immigration reform in the sense that those people might be more likely to stay?
Yes, if it's done well, of course it is. I mean, I'm not just a blanket defender of aid, but I think aid used intelligently in the poorest countries really is part of a process of helping them to catch up, as is generous trade policy. For example, recently America gave privileged market access to goods from Haiti. That's enabled a big textile factory just to open in Haiti, and that's created a lot of jobs. And so young Haitians now have some hope that they can get jobs without leaving. As it is, 85% of educated young Haitians have been leaving Haiti, and that really has trapped it in poverty.
Finally, the notion of multiculturalism. In Europe, there have been mixed successes of multiculturalism. I think it's fair to say that in the United States, there have been more undeniable successes in the mixing of various cultures who came here from other lands. In your view, is multiculturalism a positive phenomenon for the globe if people are moving around, sharing, less, behind linguistic barriers and the like?
Well, I think there's quite a lot of evidence that that integration is the way to go. That if we just have communities that don't integrate at all, for example, don't learn English in America, then there's new research evidence showing that the people who don't learn English are actually not only more detached from what's going on in America, but as a result, they're less inclined to support the provision of public goods. They're less willing to pay taxes to contribute to the communal good. And so trying to move to encourage populations to integrate is something that America has long been very good at. That doesn't mean that they have to become identikit Americans, but they do have to become part of society.
Professor of Economics Paul Collier is the author of the new book, Exodus, Immigration and Multiculturalism in the 21st Century. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
I can name that tune, Daydream Believer. Right? So in our conversation about daydreaming, we're hearing that being at work inspires inner contemplation.
I dream about making a difference in the world, doing something interesting that matters. I have a desk job where I'm unfulfilled and unappreciated. I'm getting older, and I dream about busting out of this joint.
And from Colorado Springs, right about 2:30 in the afternoon, I start thinking about my dream job. We used no names there to protect the innocent daydreamers from productivity-obsessed bosses.
This is Jane Byron from Morris Plains, New Jersey. I daydream while I walk my dogs in the woods. I daydream about future grandchildren, having a career again after a long layoff, and miraculously losing 50 pounds without suffering.
I don't think Jane has anything to worry about from productivity-obsessed bosses. From Fenton, Missouri, I dream about food, lots of food, how to cook it, I make it beautiful. I dream about the yacht and the family I will eventually cook for. Everything I've worked so hard to achieve. Share your daydreams with us on this Friday, 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. And there's much more at thetakeaway.org. So you ever look over in traffic and see someone who seems to look like they don't exactly have their mind on the road?
Hey, my name's Jessica, and I'm calling from Providence, Rhode Island. I have a bit of a commute in the morning, and I always daydream in traffic about retiring, sitting on a rocking chair on a wraparound porch at dusk with a good book and a hot cup of tea.
Hey, Jessica, wake up. There's an 18-wheeler in your lane. Daydreamers out there, and we've discovered there are so many of you. One of you from Provo, Utah. I daydream many times throughout the day about traveling the world. Or from Portland, Oregon. I daydream all the time. I love it. It's how I get my best creative ideas. In school, I got in trouble for not focusing, but now as an adult, I can daydream all day. But across town there in Portlandia, one of you says, I have not daydreamt since I was much younger. I do meditate when I'm not pressed for time or when I have trouble sleeping. Why is that? Kids getting in trouble for daydreaming, people having time to fit it into their busy lifestyles. Do kids even have time for anything like pointless internal contemplation? And how valuable is the small D for daydreaming in the development of the big B for brain? Joining us, Mary Helen Immordino Yang, professor of psychology and education at the University of Southern California's Brain and Creativity Institute. Welcome.
Hello.
So would you say that daydreaming is a difficult software install for kids in our overprogrammed age right now?
Actually, I think that the brain is naturally inclined toward daydreaming in most people. And what we're finding, actually, is that daydreaming recruits a very central core network of the brain that's essential for all kinds of cognitive and emotional and social skills, things like being able to imagine the future and to learn from your mistakes, things like being able to have memories that are meaningful to you about your past experiences, being able to make moral judgments about social situations, not just about sort of what's happening in the situation, but about what it means for the kind of people that are involved and what the kind of underlying values are. So daydreaming and the brain network that support it turn out to be super important, actually, for child development and also for adult brain health.
So daydreaming is actually a pre-installed software app, and we add apps at our peril and sort of erase the impact of daydreaming by crowding it out. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, sort of. What we're finding, and this is our lab and also, you know, many other labs for about 10 years now, are finding that the brain, in a very sort of coarse, big level sense, is organized around what you might call two big brain networks that are recruited for different kinds of processing. One of these networks is this daydreaming network that kind of turns inward and allows you to make meaning and kind of integrate information with memories and with values and with emotional feelings. The other network allows us to pay attention to the world and to look at, you know, that phone dinging in front of you or to watch that, you know, 18-wheeler that's coming over into your lane while you're driving. And so what we know about the brain is that there's this very basic kind of toggling switch where you move almost like a seesaw, like a teeter-totter, inwardly or outwardly, but you can't co-activate those two brain networks very efficiently. They flip off with one another. So what that tells us is that, and anyone who daydreams knows this, when you're daydreaming, you don't have as much attention into the world. When you're being distracted and really paying attention into the world, you don't daydream or think about the deep meaning of things. So what it tells us for child development is that it's quite possible, although this is just a hypothesis at this point, that when we systematically bias children's brain development toward paying attention to things in the world, video games, you know, cell phones dinging, TV on all the time, stuff happening all the time in front of you, as compared to allowing them some time to kind of reflect and be free from external distractions so that you can let that internal mind network kind of try itself out and play things out, we might systematically be biasing children's social brain development towards a kind of more shallow, action-oriented, kind of entertain-me mentality.
All right, so that's the hypothesis being tested by Mary Helen Immordino Yang, professor of psychology and education at the University of Southern California's Brain and Creativity Institute, a laboratory. In a very different laboratory in New Hampshire, Jessica Leahy is also with us, former teacher. You would say that hypothesis is pretty plausible, right, Jessica?
Absolutely. I got interested in this topic because I write about kids learning from their mistakes, rebounding from their mistakes. And in the process of writing about that, I found that the time I spend being idle, doing repetitive tasks like weeding or raking or walking in the woods, gave me the time I needed in order to figure out what I wanted to write about. And I couldn't exclude that from my writing process. It was just too important. That time to let things percolate was where I figured out what I was going to write. And I would write entire chapters in my head. So I became interested in, as a teacher, how dependent are my students on that process as well.
Now, do you think that teachers and, you know, getting in trouble for daydreaming and staring out the window, you know, spring fever, that sort of thing, kids have been getting in trouble for that for generations. Do you think we've increased the fear of daydreaming on the part of educators and parents, Jessica?
Well, I think it's a challenge. I mean, we hear over and over again how little time we have in the school day, and yet at the same time, we need to pack more in. And the teachers, when we see kids, you know, when I'm in charge of study hall, I know if I look around and someone's not paying attention to what they're supposed to be doing, I have a tendency to snap them out of it. But I think after reading Dr. Imordino Yang's research, I'll be a little more reluctant to do that.
Actually, a class in daydreaming. Who knows? It's Jessica Leahy, a former teacher who is writing a book in New Hampshire and has studied this subject in her own work. Mary Helen Imordino Yang, is daydreaming something that can be cultivated specifically? Is inner contemplation something that you can practice, that you can condition for?
The evidence suggests that it is. So in adults, many people find that meditation helps to sort of encourage these networks. But you don't necessarily have to meditate to encourage these networks. The way you do it is it's by its very nature not effortful. So you need to turn down the outside distractions, you know, shut off the social media, and instead spend time with your real, you know, friends and relations in person or just alone. Like Ms. Leahy said, you can go for a walk in the woods or you can weed your garden or whatever it is you enjoy doing and just kind of let your mind wander. How many people have had really great insights in the shower, you know? And this is the kind of thinking that actually is most integrative, most divergent, most creative sometimes. And like she also said, we're sort of systematically undermining this kind of thinking in the way that we design our educational system sometimes.
Well, for both of you, it would be impolite of me to daydream in the middle of this conversation, but thank you so much. We'll send you off into the weekend daydreaming. Jessica Leahy, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Jessica's an English teacher and writer in Wolfsboro, New Hampshire, and Mary Helen Imordino Yang is a professor of psychology at the University of Southern California's Brain and Creativity Institute. Happy daydreaming to you, Mary Helen.
Thank you very much.
We want you to join the conversation. As always, remember, as part of our series, Young Nation Under God, we're hosting a live chat today from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. UNC sociology professor Lisa Pierce and I will be discussing the changing role of religion in American society, especially for the millennial generation. We want your questions, stories, testimonials, like Kate from Riverdale.
I grew up Catholic, ran with the Protestants in high school, and discovered Judaism in college. I converted to Judaism, attempted rabbinical school, but was forced to leave when I came out. I then married an Episcopal priest, and she and I have a wonderful theological life together.
Great story. Ran with the Protestants. Sounds like a rock band. I have all their albums. Tell us your story at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.